Excuse me, mister. Don't you think we should be let in on what's happening?
What's happening, sir, is that you're being held by four very dangerous men armed with machine guns.
I suppose you ask a foolish question.
All right, pipe down.
Quiet.
Nobody gave a shit about
when
we first came on. Anyone with half a brain, myself included, thought it was destined to fail.
Spectacular. But you got lucky.
All you motherfuckers are gonna pay. You are the ones who are the ball lickers.
We're making a podcast.
Please clap.
And welcome back to another powerful transmission of Reboot Deboot. I'm your co-host, Griffin.
Here, reluctantly, I guess, Alex. Powerful transmission.
powerful transmission.
Uh-huh.
Now, Alex, we actually have a question that got fielded to you on Twitter.
Oh, no. Okay.
So someone asked... Dear Reboot Deboot, and then in brackets, Alex,
okay.
What if God was one of us? Just a slob like one of us. Just a stranger on the bus trying to make his way home.
Yeah.
Yeah. How does that make you feel?
I was not actually a big fan of that song when it was out. It does kind of generally remind me of the late 90s, but not in a fun way. I don't know.
Okay.
More of a Matchbox 20 guy.
Really? Okay, so you are their fan. All right.
Of Matchbox 20? I don't know if they're still doing stuff, are they?
What?
I think didn't Rob Thomas go start Wendy's and do his own thing?
I don't know.
Okay.
Rob Thomas. Yeah, how you been, Alex?
Good. Been doing great. Not a lot of watching stuff this week besides for this thing, but otherwise good. I don't know. I don't have a lot to report. What about you?
Well, how's work been?
It's been fine. I think they're changing a transformer in the building today. Not there.
Ooh. Right. Decepticon or Autobot?
I don't know. What were the names of the weird dinosaur ones?
I cannot remember.
Okay.
Dinobots, no?
I don't remember. The only Transformers that I watched, though.
I like the Velociraptor. Can't remember its name, but it was cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, you know. I showed Alicia and Josh the movie Low last night.
Oh, the one where the dude wants to have a funeral? Is that it?
No, it's where he's looking for his girlfriend, so he summons that demon, and the whole thing takes place in, like, a blacked-out room.
Hello. Yeah, I remember that. I watched that. That was good.
Yeah, so it was good. It's the second time I'd seen it. Showed him Low, and then... I think that's pretty much it. It's been a bog standard week, as the French would say. Might mow the grass today, front and back, because it's supposed to rain tomorrow, and we're going to get a storm system in. So, you know, got to take care of all the stuff before that causes larger problems.
The movie I was thinking of was Get Low, where Robert Duvall plays this hermit who decides he wants to have a funeral for himself before he dies.
Mm-hmm.
Sissy mm-hmm, SpaceX.
Mm-hmm, 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 mm-hmm.
Yep. That's good.
I mean, there is some, like, big stuff to be talked about, but it's not really our platform. I do want to pick your brain later, though, about it.
Okay.
I will say, up front, though, we're going to be taking next week off because it's the first annual Rebooties.
Mm-hmm.
So you and I are going to have to take some time to talk to the judges. And it is award season. So we're going to have to take some time to talk to the judges, go through the considerations. But next week, we're going to take a break. And then the week after, we'll be back with a special 100 episode of Reboot Deboot, and it's going to be the Rebooties Award Show.
Get ready. Place your bets, your over unders, your only betting time.
Interesting. Well, Alex, do you want to tell our audience, our hearers, what we're all going to be talking about today?
Yeah, we watched The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3 from 1974, and The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3, but spelled with words, from 2009. Oh, wait, no, other way around. 1974 is the word 1, 2, and 3.
So, Alex, in general, what is your experience with The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3?
Okay, 1-2-3. I remember seeing trailers for the 2009 one, but I never saw it. That's really about it. I don't remember. I remember thinking, like, so this is around the time where it's starting to really sink in for me that I am not enjoying John Travolta's work anymore. I think this is after Battlefield Earth, and I remember thinking, this seems like a strange move for him.
You might want to give him a pass
for this.
Well, this time period of John Travolta.
Why? I mean,
because he was suffering with the loss of his son Jet.
Oh, sure. I mean, that I don't think that excuses Battlefield Earth.
Not Battlefield Earth, but you know, there were some of the decisions in his movies and some of his attitude and roles had to be influenced by the stress and the grief. And
maybe,
you know,
I would say that if it's impacting things that much, maybe just don't take the job. It's not, he doesn't need the money. But I was looking at his IMDb and I was like, man, maybe I only enjoyed about a 10-year period of John Travolta movies.
Sure.
But yeah, so I never saw this, and I hadn't really thought about it until a week ago. That's about it. I think I was vaguely aware. I became vaguely aware it was a remake at some point, but I knew nothing about the remake until last weekend when I looked it up for this. What about you?
Had you ever seen the 74 one or anything?
No, I was less aware of that than the 2009 one. I also didn't know there was a book until, again, last week. I did read a little bit.
Yeah,
of it,
you did?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I can,
Well,
talk about that a little bit.
Okay.
I didn't finish it because I'm a slow reader. And, you know,
only
4 work days, but
I am totally, I was totally unknown to The Taking of Pelham. I knew the plot. I knew the general plot. And I knew that it had been a remake, and that was it.
Were you also kind of like, they hijack a subway? What?
No, I knew. I was like, it's a train heist.
But like, I was like, I know. Stationary most of the time.
Right, but I was like, yeah, I know they take hostages in a train, and it's like a hostage thing. But I didn't. That is all I knew. I wasn't sure of the details of the heist, but I knew that was the thing. It is also a 1998 television movie starring Edward James Olmos, Vincent D'Onofrio, Donnie Wahlberg, Richard Schiff, and Lorraine Bracco. And the music was made by Stuart Copeland.
Whoa, the Fanfare of the Common Man guy? Wait, no, that's Aaron Copeland. Never mind.
Stuart Copeland is from The Police.
Oh, okay.
He also was the drummer in The Police, but he also has done a shit ton of video game music and other movies.
He's a composer guy. That's cool.
Yeah. So I sat down and I settled in to Taking of Pelham 1-2-3. Now, I had not read the novel. The novel came out in 1973. How far did you get into the novel?
I made it about a quarter of the way through reading earnestly, and then I sort of skimmed to about the halfway mark.
And how, from what you read, was it good?
I thought it was pretty good with some big caveats. So it's one of those books where, like, it kind of is jumping back and forth between different point of view characters, right?
Mm-hmm.
So all four of the hijackers are point of view characters, which I like. And they even, so like Longman, the guy in the 74 one with the cold, who's like the motorman, mm-hmm. they have like more backstory about how he met the main guy, which is kind of neat. But then they also do this thing. It's this guy's writing under a pen name, John Godey. I forgot his real name, but a few of the POV characters, like one of them is that, like, the one black dude who's on the train, and his character, like, point of view voice is like a 70s black revolutionary, but like very clearly written by a white guy. That kind of is not great. Yeah. And then another point of view character, like, it's a crime novel set in New York from the 70s.
Morton Friedgood is the writer of Pelham.
There's a lot of slurs in it. Super, like, people casually, just sort of everyone referring to black people as a specific kind of digging implement. Like, all over the place.
Good.
Nice. Yeah. I mean, I guess it's probably, like, it might be authentic for the time and the place or whatever, but it's still just, you know, a little like, whoa, what are we, okay.
Yeah, no, I'm familiar. There are some I've come across some problematic stories, but where like that's not great, didn't age well.
The parts where it seems like this John, I'm going to keep on calling him John Godey. He's like clearly really, really into the subway system. Like,
is he?
There's so much if you thought that the sort of the movie, like Taking a Pelham 1-2-3, the 70s one at least, has like a lot of subway factoids for you, there's even more packed into here. Like,
interesting,
really minuscule stuff. There's also just a lot more. There's also just like a shitload of POV characters, like too many in my opinion. The biggest thing that I noticed, though, was that Lieutenant Garber is basically not a character in the book. He does show up. There's someone with that name. There's Lieutenant Garber. But the guy who was doing the talking to the hijackers most of the time is this character called Lieutenant Prescott, who is a black dude who I'm a little I have maybe a uncharitable idea about why they may have changed that to Lieutenant Garber and gave him for Walter Matthau.
What's the uncharitable? I mean, you know,
I think they just didn't want a black lead in this movie.
I mean, it's of the time, you know. Yeah. I can see the racism,
but it's pretty weird, yeah. Because like, there's this Lieutenant Garber character who is basically sort of Rico Patron. He's basically like that guy in the book. And Prescott is sort of Garber. There's little differences in there, but a lot of the book just made it like one to one into the 70s movie.
So Morton Friedgood was born in 1913 and he passed away in 2006. He wrote under the pen name John Godey. He was born in Brooklyn, New York, and he began writing at a young age. During the 40s, he had several articles and short stories published in Cosmopolitan, Esquire, and other magazines, along with working full time in the motion picture industry in New York City. He also served as an interman in World War II. That was from his Wikipedia. I thought maybe he might have been a railroad guy if he was like so into the subway or something. But
really into him, and maybe we didn't know about autism yet. But
sure, that's a stretch, but sure.
Someone who's super into trains is literally a diagnostic criteria for.
So, in the movie of Taking Pelham 1-2-3, in the 70s, they have nicknames Mr. Gray, Mr. Blue, Mr. Green. This would be referenced and an homage in Quentin Tarantino's film Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah. Oh, and in the book, actually, in the credits for the 70s one, they also have their real names, which are, or like they have the real character names in there, which are the names from the book, but like the writer name that John Travolta takes is just the name of the dude from the book and the movie. The color coded things are not in there at all, though. That was a added
specifically to the movie.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So since the film's release, no number 6 train has ever been scheduled to leave Pelham Bay Park Station at either 1323 or 0123 by the New York City Transit Authority. This was the practice for many years until the policy was discontinued. Trains are still not scheduled to leave Pelham Bay Park Station at either 1:23 a.m. or p.m.
Yeah, I love that too.
There's one of Robert Shaw's favorite pastimes during breaks in filming was playing ping pong on table sets up on the station's concourse. However, he reportedly badly beat all of the opposing challengers. Like, anyone who stepped up, he was just wiping the floor with them.
For some reason, it's very funny for me to think of a British man playing ping pong. It seems like it would be beneath them.
Walter Matthau convinced Hector Alonso to stop smoking during the shooting of the film. Hmm. The $1 million number and denomination of bills as ordered by the hijackers would weigh 33 pounds.
Yeah, that's why they told him to get a wheelbarrow, right?
The motorman of Pelham 123, Danny Doyle, is played by James Broderick, father of Matthew Broderick.
Oh, that's cool.
Peter Stone came up with the idea for Mr. Green's constant sneezing. Steven Spielberg was considered as director. Filmed mostly in tunnels leading to a decommissioned IND Court Street station in Brooklyn, the station itself served as Grand Central in 28th. And is currently home of the New York City Transit Museum. The actor who played the role of subway guard was named Jim Pelham.
Oh, ooh.
Robert Shaw and Julius Harris played villains in two Bond films. Shaw was Donald Red Grant, the main villain from Russia with Love, and Harris was Teehee, one of the villains in Live and Let Live by 1973.
Yeah, they really stopped trying at a certain point. Those names.
That's like a Hideo. T.H.E.E.
Yeah, that's a Hideo Kojima level, like, thought out name.
By coincidence, both characters were killed by Bond while on a train.
Mm.
Walter Matthau had not been on the New York subway in many years, even though he was born and raised in New York. Walter Matthau wasn't a fan of the script's foul language.
That's wild to me. That's
Walter Matthau's son Charlie says the final shot is Matthau imitating him, imitating Charlie Chaplin.
Where he pokes his head in through the door. That is like a very yeah. God, that last scene is amazing. That's really good.
Walter Matthau wore a curly hair wig as a joke for his audition as Garber.
I like that. Keeping it light.
The taking of Pelham 123 was the second time that Robert Shaw played a kidnapper. First time was in the British production Tomorrow at 10 from 1963. Mm. Included among the American Film Institute's 2001 list of 400 movies nominated for the top 100 most heart-pounding American movies.
Okay. It does have a really good base to it.
Robert Shaw is shown holding a 1911 pistol as a widely circulated poster for the film, but the pistol his character uses in the film's climactic shootout is actually a Browning High Power.
All right.
In episode 8, season 23 of Kings and Queens, Doug, played by Kevin James, learns his father-in-law, played by Jerry Stiller, used to be an actor. The film clip Doug watches is actor Jerry Stiller playing Rico Patrone in The Taking of Pelham 123.
Oh, that's amazing. I like that. That's it's like a in Scrubs when he finds out that the janitor was in.
Oh, the janitor, yeah.
Was in The Fugitive? Yeah.
He does the same, like, he does that scene in the tunnel, right?
When he puts his takes the like wide stance and, yeah.
Yeah. Shoot the gun.
I don't care.
By the way, seeing Jerry Stiller in this made me really happy.
I was so happy. And at the end, towards the end, I was like, God, I want a Walter Matthau, Jerry Stiller buddy cop movie. This is so fun watching really them just knock on doors and chit-chat in between.
I couldn't help but think of George yelling Serenity Now and then, like, and then his father yelling Serenity now.
Yeah, it's this is the closest thing to a serious role. I mean, it's still like this movie is still like half a comedy, but it's just wild seeing him play a cop. It was very interesting
and young too. Yeah, like young. He's still got old man vibes.
He just doesn't look as
old. But everybody does. Walter Matthau needs a cane in that movie. Like,
he's moving around.
He's kind of shambling.
He's hunched over a lot. He's just dressed frumpy.
Three cast members were later on Tim Allen sitcoms. Two were on Home Improvement.
Okay.
Earl Hinman is Tim Taylor's neighbor, Wilson. And Dick O'Neill is Tim's old metal shop teacher, Mr. Leonard. The third was on Last Man Standing. Hector Alonso is Mike Baxter's boss, Ed Alonzante. It had been noted that Walter Matthau had won an Oscar for Best Supporting Actor for the 1966 The Fortune Cookie over Robert Shaw for A Man of All Seasons. But in addition, Matthau shares scenes in the movie with an actor who won the Oscar for Best Supporting Actor the year before, Martin Balsam for 1,000 Clowns.
Wow. Well, Martin Balsam was the other guy who's all like pissed off at the desk the whole time, right?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no, he was called green slash long.
Was he? No.
Yeah.
He was the guy at the desk, right?
No, he wasn't. I'm looking at the IMDb right now. Martin.
Oh, okay. There are 17 hostages on the train.
Plus a conductor, right?
And so those are your fun facts for Taking of Pelham, 1, 2, 3, 1974. Mm-hmm. Released on October 2nd, 1974. The film clocks in at 104 minutes, and the budget was $3.8 million. I could not find the numbers on the box office take.
All right.
So what was your experience going into 1974 as the Taking of Pelham, 1, 2, 3? How'd you feel? What were you expecting? What did you think when the movie happened and when it got going? And by the time it wrapped up, how were you sitting with it?
I was sort of vaguely aware of the plot. I know that it's some, at least one dude, probably some dudes, hijack a subway train. And then it kind of goes from there. So I was expecting that. I was pretty pleasantly, I don't even want to say surprised because I didn't have a ton of expectations. But I had a really good time watching this. I thought it was awesome. Like the pacing of it is really cool. I like it moves between scenes really fast, but it's not like in a confusing way. It's just like it keeps the pace up the whole time for the whole movie. And it's really likable. I know Walter Matthau I like him much more in this than I did in Bad News Bears character wise. I think he's great. And the supporting cast is really good, too.
Okay. Now, briefly, go over the plot of Pelham 1, 2, 3 for our audience.
Yeah, so it kind of starts out with a bunch of shady-looking dudes, four of them, that are all wearing similar overcoats and hats. Hats are kind of later color-coordinated to their code names. These dudes all get on a train, and then they end up hijacking the train in a very sort of like planned out fashion. Like this is a heist for sure. There's some planning that went into this. Meanwhile, we have Walter Matthau working as a transit authority cop, Lieutenant Garber. And he is sort of at his day job. He's shepherding around a bunch of Japanese businessmen who work for sort of like the Japanese equivalent of the MTA.
Japanese
man.
Yeah.
And he's giving them this tour. The tour that he gives is lifted straight out of the book, all those factoids and stuff. And that's this Prescott guy does the tour for these two dudes from Boston instead of the Japanese folks. But he's kind of giving this tour where he's just like reciting a bunch of factoids and leading them all over the place. And then as he is leading them around, sort of things are deteriorating with the train. The hijackers end up hijacking the train. They drive it into a tunnel and park it. And then they uncouple like the back nine cars of the subway train so that they're only in the front car. And then they take the back nine and drive them back to the platform, or they take the front one and take it forward or whatever, and they send everyone back to the platform. Meanwhile, the folks at the sort of nerve center for the transit authority are like freaking the fuck out. They don't know what's going on with Pelham 123, why it's like gone radio silent, why it stopped, and they'd also cut the hijackers also cut power to a large area around them in the subway tunnels. They're, you know, trying to call them, no answer. The hijackers now are just in the front car. They've sent about half of the passengers from that car back, and they have them and 17 people plus this conductor. And then they answer back on the radio that they are, you know, some well-armed men who have no scruples about killing, and they've hijacked their train. And here's our list of demands. Basically, they want $1 million in an hour to release these hostages. And if they don't get that money, they're going to kill a hostage a minute for presumably for 18 minutes, and then they'll be done. So that sort of gets radioed in while Walter Matthau is like walking through there. Walter Matthau ends up being the guy on the radio who's talking to, what's the name? Gray? I don't. The character is Ryder, but his color.
It's Mr. Blue.
Mr. Blue, sure. Okay, yeah. Robert Shaw.
He's Mr. Blue.
The guy with the English accent.
The guy in Jaws. The shark hunter in Jaws.
Yeah, he's got a doll's eyes. Yeah, so Robert Shaw is the guy communicating with Matthau most of the time. And then it goes back and forth with like these scenes of like them on the radio and then sort of the city like marshaling a response. There are these fun scenes where we cut over to like the mayor of New York, who is never named in this. He's just the mayor, but he's dealing with like this killer flu. The first scene we see is him in bed getting some sort of like steroid shot in the butt because he's so sick, and there's this nurse around him, and he's got his mayoral aide, or like the deputy mayor, whatever, is talking to him about it. We kind of jump around back and forth with like this stuff happening. The city ends up deciding to pay the ransom. So there's a really fun like dynamic scene where they're jumping around between all these people, like counting all the money and stuff. Oh, and the whole time, the soundtrack for this movie is like so good, and really, it feels like one of those things where they had like the orchestra pit like watching the movie and then playing along to it, because it fills in like empty spaces, but it's not overbearing, and kind of like it keeps things chugging along forward. They get the money. They're getting very close down to the wire, so they have the money like situated in bags in the way that they wanted, but they're too far uptown. They have like 5 minutes left to get this money down to the subway car. And they're not going to make it in time. Walter Matthau does some quick thinking. He lies. He says it's there, but it's just taking them a minute to get it ready. That ends up buying them basically enough time. They send these two cops down with the money. There's a little bit of a accidental shootout. The money gets dropped off for the hijackers. The hijackers take it. Then they sort of drop this thing in there about how are they going to escape? And then someone's like, well, maybe they'll just send the train car on its way and then they'll go a different way. And everyone's like, no, you idiot, that can't happen. There's this thing called a dead man feature where, you know, you have to be applying heavy pressure to this, to the throttle, basically, and if you let go of it, the train just comes to a stop. Surprise, surprise, they have a way to defeat this feature that they've thought about. Also, one of the hijackers is a former motor man. I'm still not totally clear on what the difference between a motor man and a conductor is. I guess the motor man drives. I don't know. The hijackers, they fit this device on this train so that it can run without a motorman or a conductor. They send the train on its way. The MTA.
Motormen are responsible for day-to-day cleaning, repair, and routine maintenance of the engine aboard the train, like a train and or ship. Whereas a conductor is just there to control them.
Okay. Well, so there you go. They stuff all this money in their totes. They get out of the train. They send the train on its way. Garber and some cops are like trying to follow the train on surface streets. Garber has this revelation that like, oh, maybe they actually found a way to defeat this dead man thing. And they start checking these emergency exits. Also, this whole time, they've been talking about how they're pretty sure there's an undercover cop on the train. Like Walter Matthau and crew.
Yes.
In the book, that character is a POV character who just kind of occasionally talks about how he feels guilty about not sort of not Mark Wahlberging all these hijackers.
That is William Snikowski as the hippie, an undercover police officer.
Yeah, he's described almost exactly the same in the book too. Like they're like long hair, sunglasses, poncho. That's like his description in the book. He's always, his character's an asshole. But anyway, so as the hijackers leaving, this cop jumps out too, and like all the lights are out in the tunnel. So the cop like sort of jumps out, takes a bit of a tumble, and he ends up lying down on the tracks. And the hijackers don't see him. So the hijackers all go to this emergency exit. They're on this platform. They're getting ready to leave. And then one of them, the sort of, not quite the wild card because he wasn't brought on last minute, but he's been like a loose cannon the whole time. He's the first one to kill anyone. And he's just kind of an asshole the whole time.
Mr. Gray.
Yeah, Mr. Gray. So they're all getting ready to leave their weapons behind. Mr. Gray doesn't like that idea, says he's going to take his with him. He's just going to walk up into the New York City streets with a big submachine gun. Mr. Blue does not like that. He ends up shooting him in the chest with a pistol that he had on him. And then while this is all happening, was it Mr. Green? Is that the other one?
No.
Mr. Brown stood out on the platform.
Yes, there's Mr. Brown, Gray, Green, and Blue.
Yeah, so Mr. Brown is stood out on the platform by this emergency exit, kind of looking up and down the tunnel, and then our cop buddy, who is laying in the track, very sneakily pulls out this like snub-nosed revolver, and he ends up shooting Mr. Brown from pretty far away. That guy dies. Then Robert Shaw / Mr. Blue comes out. He tells Mr. Green / Longman to just get out of here. We'll meet up at the designated spot later. At this point, Garber has caught on to stuff. He misses Mr. Green, but he comes in the same emergency exit that Mr. Green left out of. Comes down there. Right as Robert Shaw is like delivering this menacing speech to this cop he's about to kill on the track, Walter Matthau pulls a gun on him. I think Robert Shaw, he asks like, do you execute people in this state? Walter Matthau is like, no. And he goes, shame. And then he shoves his foot into the third rail. And we watch him just like convulse a little bit as smoke comes out of his fucking ears.
For people who may not know, what's the third rail?
It is an extremely high voltage, high current electrical line that carries electricity to all of the train cars. And if you touch it, you die. That's sort of where we have the term like the third rail of politics. It's like a third rail now gets used as like a euphemism for a thing you generally want to avoid, or like a thing that if you touch it, you're in trouble.
Yeah, that scene was shocking to me.
I was not expecting him to go out like that.
Yeah, when I was like, Ryder, in that moment, I'm like, this is the coolest death scene I've ever seen. And it wasn't even, I think it was just the shock of it.
Yeah.
No pun intended.
Oh, yeah, good one. It is very jolt. Like, I thought Garber was maybe just going to shoot him or disarm her. But yeah, when he died, I was like, whoa, gee, this guy's all business.
All business. That's so hardcore.
Also, this whole time, the train that still has a bunch of hostages in it is just like running fucking wild down this track. going way too fast.
All the lights, all the signal lights have been switched to green, which means that the train will just keep going as fast as the engine has been set. Now, if it hits a red line, it means that brakes will automatically stop up. Yeah, grabbers will come out and they will stop the train.
Yeah.
But if this train does not get stopped, it will eventually dead end at its location full force, killing the 17 passengers on board.
Yeah, and they've sent it all the way to South Ferry, which I guess is, I think, the Coney Island ferry stop. I'm not a New York guy.
I've been to New York. I was in New York for 4 days. My knowledge of New York is very
limited. You didn't memorize the subway system when you were there?
I did not. I know. I should have.
Yeah, just for this. Anyway, so there's a lot of like drama with the hostages. Will they die? Won't they? They end up fine. But it's definitely harrowing while it's happening. But there's a very fun scene. There was a woman. She's also in the book too. This in the book she's just described as a wino. There's this lady passed out on one of the benches for the entire movie, and she's even sleeping through the part where the train is rushing, but it finally comes to this kind of jarring stop, and there's this very comical scene where she slides down the length of the car on this bench, kind of like pops to one side a little bit, and then sits up, and I think she like looks around and realizes it isn't her stop, and then goes back to sleep, right? It's pretty funny. There's a lot of
She's been asleep through gunfire.
Yeah, like multiple people and killed with very close vicinity to her. Lots of gunfire. And it just pops up at the end. It's great. And it's a lot of fun, like comedic beats in this. So now we're at 3 out of the 4 hijackers down. While this crime was happening, the MTA/transit cops, they sort of put together, like, one of these people is probably an ex-motorman. They put together this list of like every motorman they've fired in the last 10 years. They end up with like a list of like 90, but then for various reasons, they're able to narrow it down to like 8. And then Walter Matthau and Jerry Stiller, who's been around kind of providing fun color commentary, they go and they start knocking on doors, just checking people. Oh, also, Mr. Green, the motorman, the ex-motorman guy, he's had like a gnarly cold the whole time. He's been sniffling, and on the radio, we've heard him sneeze over the radio sometimes, and Walter Matthau always says Gesundheit. Be important in a second. So they knock on some doors. They're interviewing these various motormen. They finally end up at Mr. Green's apartment. They knock on it. The camera cuts into his apartment, and he's got all of his money spread on his bed, and he's rolling around in it like a fucking pig and shit. It's great. He's very happy. He wraps it up in a blanket, puts it in an oven, he lets the cops in. They have their sort of little like back and forth thing. Fun little exchange. It doesn't seem like anything's coming from it. Walter Matthau and Jerry Stiller are leaving the apartment, and right as the door's about to close, Green sneezes and the door's closed. And the door cracks back open and Walter Matthau's head pops in there smiling and he goes, Gesundheit. And then we roll credits.
He almost got away with it.
Almost. If it weren't for those meddling transit cops.
He almost got away with it.
Yeah. What did you think of it? Did you have a fun time with this?
It was okay.
Oh,
okay. It was all right. I watched. I think my bar for like movies from the 70s has been set too high, because I was like, fuck, man, like this is the era of Dirty Harry and like Steve McQueen, and I'm gonna get like a really awesome like high like hostage tent situation, and it was kind of. I don't know. It was a little bit muted.
I was really happy it wasn't like a super, super gritty hostage, but I was like, man, it is like very watchable. Just like moved along quick.
I mean, it was watchable, and it was don't.
At a very good time.
I'd give it a 6 out of like 7, 6 or 7.
I feel like you evaluate your thing, but it's like a 6 on the scale of like a like gritty crime movies that
like overall.
Okay.
Like I preferred Thomas Crown Affair with Steve McQueen more than this.
Oh, I mean, I like that movie more too, but this,
you know, I preferred the first Dirty Harry over this or Taxi Driver.
So you're saying you prefer some of the most well-remembered movies in history over this movie? Sure. Hot. That's what you come to the podcast for, these hot takes.
I mean, but I also really enjoy those on my, like, outside of their acclaim, those are just, you know, movies that I personally like favor, enjoy. Mm-hmm. Taking of Pelham 1, 2, 3. I mean, I guess I'll let the cat out of the bag early. I preferred the 2009 one.
Wow. Hard disagree.
Like I preferred the 2009 one. And I think it comes down it comes down to John Travolta and Denzel Washington. I think their performances.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, very different experiences this weekend.
Well, so I will say there are my criticisms of the movie are the same. Like, you're already on a time limit to get the money. You have 1 hour to get them $1 million, and for every minute you are late, they're going to kill a hostage. It's already hard enough going through that much red tape to like get the mayor to sign off, to get the city treasurer to sign off, to get this and then trans. It's already a high stakes thing. We don't need to have a car crash to like take the money out of play or anything. It's all the stakes are already high enough.
Put it on our motorcycle and it goes through.
Yeah, I get it. I thought both scenes in both movies, that was unnecessary, especially in the 2009 one. I'm like, the stakes are already high enough because it's also more of a violent movie. So I'm like, yeah, we don't need the money can arrive there on time. It's
the
still
2009 one had that funny nod where they're like, why the fuck didn't we put this money in a helicopter? And then later they get on a helicopter and they're like, okay, fine, now we're doing it.
Right.
That was funny. Yeah.
For 1974, I enjoyed it. I don't think I would ever go back and rewatch it though.
Hmm. Okay. I had a really fun time with this one. I feel like I would watch it again. Or at least recommend it to
Yeah, I think 2009 had the better ending.
I guess for the reasons you didn't like, I think we like I like the 70s one more because it was, you know, like had more levity to it and was less serious. Like there's a one or two statements that I read from the director talking about, or they were like specific, like intentionally like doing comedy at various parts. There was something when I was trying to figure out like why I didn't do a ton of research into this, like my, you know, Googling lasted about 10 or 15 minutes. I was trying to figure out why they changed the character. So have like, why wasn't Garber just this Prescott person instead? But there were some statements from the script writer who was like talking about how they changed some things specifically. Like in the book, the hijacking is a lot more, like intricate and explained, and the way they get away. Apparently I didn't make it far enough into it, but in the movie, the sort of the whole linchpin is this dead man device override thing. And there's, I guess like more to the hijacking than that in the book, but there's some interviews saying that they had to remove some of the more sort of like instructional parts of the book. They were like, we're making a movie, not a manual on how to hijack a subway.
So, right.
And then they were also like, we're really hoping that the comedy will dissuade people from thinking this is like a serious way to do things about this. They said they weren't expecting real criminals. They think they made a movie that only a kook would think was a good idea, but they were still worried about attracting kooks.
So yeah, Morton Friedman was a subway buff, as Alex stated earlier.
Big time.
The novel and film came out during the golden age of skyjacking.
Yeah, there's a bunch of that in the book. That's sort of how Hal Longman, the motorman, the ex-motorman guy and Ryder, they meet in an unemployment line, and Longman tries to make small talk by showing, like, he's always reading a newspaper in the line, and then he's like, there's a bunch of headlines about these hijacked planes, and they end up getting onto the subject of hijacking subway cars.
From 1968 to 1979, there were just so many, like, plane hijackings and shit. However, New York was edging towards a financial crisis as crime had risen citywide, and the subway was perceived as neither safe nor reliable at the time. Like, I don't know, 74, watching it, I was like, okay, it's good to have it in my head. Like, it's good to see Walter Matthau and Jerry Stiller and Robert Shaw. Like, it's good to have this. It's good to have another, like, oh, so that's where Quentin Tarantino got the idea from. You know, like, another, like, yeah, Hallmark movie or, like, cinema film, like a grindhouse film almost, like Death Wish or something. You know, it's good to have it in there. I have it. I understand. I've seen the movie now. So for that, it's crucial. It's so crucial to have it. My personal opinion, though, I preferred 2009's depiction of Taking Pelham 123. But well, a six for me is like high praise anyway.
Okay. Yeah, I'm trying to think of other, like, sort of more modern movies I would say at a similar time with. Not quite Ocean's 11.
No, Ocean's 11 was way more stylistic.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think
and not as violent.
I'm trying to think of movies that sort of balance the. There's action and like death stuff happening, but it's also like the mood is relatively light the whole time. And
Snatch,
it's broken up with comedy. No, I don't. Not
Rock and Roller.
Not something that heavily. Stop just talking about Tony Scott movies or Ridley Scott or
I.
I don't know. I'll think on that on my own, but we can. You want to talk about the 2009 one?
So, 2009, Taking Pelham 123. John Travolta chose not to promote the film with the rest of the cast because he was still reeling from the loss of his son, Jet Travolta.
I would say, why make the movie?
First blood is a railroad term describing the first time an engineer killed someone on the tracks.
Yeah, that's in the book, too. Interesting.
The title derives from a train's radio call sign. When a New York City subway train leaves to make a run, it's given a call sign based on the time and where it left. In this case, Pelham Bay Park Station at 1:23 p.m.
Okay.
In the movie, John Travolta's character recounts a story about bringing an ass model to Iceland. The earring that Travolta is wearing is the flag of Iceland.
Okay.
Nicolas Cage turned down playing the role of Ryder to prepare for our bad lieutenant, Port of Call, New Orleans.
You don't watch that movie. That's hilarious.
The original movie was released in 1964, and the remake in 2009, 35 years later. Robert Shaw starred in 1974's version, and James Gandolfini starred in the 2009 version. Both men died of heart attacks 35 years apart, with Shaw dying in 1978 and Gandolfini dying in 2013. Both men were age 51.
Wow. There's like some, did you know Lincoln's secretary was called Kennedy and Kennedy's secretary was called Lincoln level numbered bullshit.
This is the third time Denzel Washington and James Gandolfini have worked together. The first was in Crimson Tide, 1995, and the second was in Fallen, 1998. Ryder's men hijack the train at 2 p.m., but in the novel it's at 1:23 p.m., like in the number of the train. James Gandolfini, Michael Rispoli, and Jason Carbon previously starred in The Sopranos.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
John Travolta's character is wearing a Breitling watch brand watch, which the actor often models in their print advertisement.
Here we go. Free watches for that.
This was Tony Scott's last movie to be filmed with Panavision and camera lenses. Panavision cameras and lenses.
Okay.
The film is a key plot point in the novel. In the novel, Super Mega Saves the Troops from 2021. Yeah. So, you know, not much fun facts, but. So how come you didn't like this one?
Sort of for the inverse of the reasons you liked it, I guess. Like, okay, so I do want to say that I thought Denzel eminently watchable. He's definitely my favorite thing about this movie, and like the high point of the whole thing for me is just like Denzel Washington in it. But I was not a big fan of the tonal shift towards like the super seriousness. And I thought John Travolta's character was just bad. I did not enjoy his sort of, I guess it's like a John Travolta thing, but the parts where he just starts like randomly yelling about shit. I guess it's like a high stress situation in the world of the movie, but I don't know, for whatever reason, like I don't buy John Travolta as a dude with neck tats. I don't buy John Travolta as a guy talking about like making people his bitch in prison. I don't know. I thought there was sort of like a more well-rounded ensemble kind of thing going on in the older one too.
Well, see, the unsavory, like, I don't buy John Travolta as that character fully, because I can buy him being an intelligent hijacker, and I can buy him being, like, the waxing poetic over the radio, like, saying a lot, but not saying anything, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But the counter to John Travolta's like energy and his violence of Denzel Washington, the chemistry that they create throughout the film, I think is what sells it for me. If it was just John Travolta, I would not like this film. Denzel is the like saving. He is the linchpin of this film. It is his acting ability, and it is his ability to play these low moments and slow moments, and to command the camera and the scene that really bring the balance to this film.
Yeah, for me, it's like I agree with the Denzel stuff. It's just not enough for like the whole movie to be, especially because like coming from like really enjoying the original one. And then coming to this again, like I thought Denzel Washington was awesome. I feel like they had so many good actors in this that like just didn't get enough to do. Like James Gandolfini is barely in it and seems not to be trying that much. I don't know if you got that vibe.
A lot. So like Louis Guzman, James Gandolfini,
John Turturro
really seem like they're just there for the paycheck.
Yeah, they all seem like checked out. Like they're barely. I mean, like James Gandolfini's a really good actor, and it seemed like he was intentionally playing this super flat.
Well, I mean, John Turturro too.
John Turturro too, and Luis Guzman has like nothing to do. When I saw that Luis Guzman was in this, I was excited. I thought I was like, oh, obviously he's going to be the Jerry Stiller character, and this is going to be awesome. Him and Denzel Washington are going to do like a fun buddy cop. No, that's not in there at all. He's not even.
Yeah.
He's there with Ryder / John Travolta, but he doesn't even get any fun lines. He's just like super serious, like, oh, I'm going to die today. And then he does. And it's just.
The lamenting about the death, I'm like, there's a better use of Louis Guzman in this film. And it needs to be the Jerry Stiller controller.
Yeah, I was like Jerry Stiller or just like Longman / guy, Brett, fuck, what was his name? Longman, the motorman from the original one. Like, even, that guy was just like so much more of a actual character. They did kind of, they took all four hijackers in this one, and then two of them are just basically written out of the movie. They're there only as bodies. I don't think they talk at all.
Yeah.
And then Luis Guzman gets maybe like a quarter of the amount of stuff to do as the original Motorman hijacker equivalent. This really is just sort of like, it's the Denzel Washington, John Travolta show for most of the movie.
It is.
They're like, there's not, yeah, the sort of, the idea of like an ensemble cast sort of went out, got thrown away. I mean, and I get it, like, John Travolta and Denzel Washington are, maybe John Travolta a little less so, but this is like pretty nearing like the apexes of their popularity. Denzel for sure, maybe John Travolta's on a bit of a down swing at this point. I think he was doing old guys on motorcycles or Wild Hogs. Is that what the fucking movie was called?
Oh, God.
This is like,
old guys on motorcycles?
But this, like, he's on a, John Travolta is like not, it's like Battlefield Earth, Wild Hogs, and one or two other movies like in that vein is like what John Travolta is up to at this point in his career.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't like. Look at the cat. Like, I should have really liked it, but I also okay. So Tony Scott, who I like a decent number of his movies a lot, had a really good time with Domino, True Romance. I like a lot, and he also is he did a couple of short movies for this BMW produced a series of short films called The Driver that were, you know, before Clive Owen was famous. Clive Owen movies.
I remember those.
BMW around. He directed a few of those. He directed some of the best ones in those. Like, I like Tony Scott, but some of the very like Tony Scott stuff in here, I think is, it grated on me a little bit. I do not enjoy the, they stopped, they didn't do it a ton after the opening bits of the movie, but that thing where he goes into the ultra low frame rate.
Yeah, that one.
I find that extremely grating. And it's everywhere for the first 30 minutes of the movie. And then a little more after that.
Yeah. It's,
the choice. It's definitely like Tony Scott. Like, because that shit was all over Domino, too, right? They do like the low frame rate, sort of blurry, lots of whooshing noises while like the sun would move or something.
Yeah, I mean, Tony Scott is a director. I always forget he exists. Yeah, and then I will come across a Tony Scott movie and I'm like, oh, right. And then when he does like the slow frames or like he tries, you can tell he's trying to be stylistic, but it never really gets there.
Yeah, even when I don't hate it, like in Domino, I think they have a lot of that. It's still just kind of like, I wish they would not do this so much.
And let like, me just... I think my favorite Tony Scott films, Top Gun and Beverly Hills Cop 2, but I prefer Beverly Hills Cop.
Yeah, sure.
Like, I, and even then, what, those are both mid-80s?
Yeah, it seems like there's some period where, like, late 90s into the early 2000s, he really gets into the sort of stuff. True Romance, really good. I like that a lot.
Oh, he did that movie. You know what? Actually, I like Domino. I do like Domino. You've mentioned it. I like Domino. Domino's cool. He did that movie Unstoppable with Denzel about the train.
Yeah, a different Denzel train movie. Yeah. Okay. Oh, and the end.
This taking of Pelham 123, the parts that elevate it for me are the interplay between Denzel and John Travolta. And it's that chemistry where I'm like, fuck, this is awesome. Like, this... And I understand John Travolta can't play, like, the tough guy like he's supposed to. And I understand that he's maybe dealing with some stuff from the passing of Jet. But
I would have
Denzel's calm to this, like Denzel's balance. It's great. Like it fits the tone of the movie. It counters the tone of the movie so well. It brings it to such a reality of like this heightened violence, heightened stakes, heightened danger. There's screaming. There's big car crash. There's a car rolling. And then we have like just normal ass Denzel Washington, who's trying to just, I'm just a dude. I came into work today. I'm facing a demotion. I might be under investigation. I just want to get through this shit.
I would have like. I think I just don't know why you make John Travolta like this style of ultra violent weirdo. Like I would have bought him so much more if he was like more of the Robert Shaw style of hijacker. If he was like cool and calculated, I'd totally buy him doing that.
Sure.
I do think I feel like there's some stuff that I think they must have just slipped in here because of the time. Like the fact that the twist at the end is that he's a Wall Street guy, right? Like when were the bailouts?
Oh, right.
I was like, oh, the most hated men in America at the time. Yes.
Right.
I thought that was really funny. That was a fun little twist. Like, oh, he doesn't care about the $10 million.
Because he made $300 million.
We got to check the ETFs on this. Check the futures right. market. That was really funny.
Because he's the gold standard. Like, the price of gold went up like 87,000%.
He's watching the stock market like crash and the price of gold go up live on the train. The whole time, I kind of was like, is he just a fucking gold bug? What is that? I was like, I know this is probably important. They're not just showing this for no reason.
I was like, is he a friend of Ted Anderson or like what's going on here?
I was like, what? He's just like smiling? Is he smiling about the chaos? He's very focused on this gold price thing.
Yeah, man. Like, there are some parts of Pelham that I'm just like, eh. Like, I can take it or leave it. But
there's the one black guy on the train, too, who's like the Army Ranger, who that woman is like, you know, my husband was an Army Ranger. And he just sort of, I shouldn't laugh. This guy got done so dirty for a small character. He's like,
yeah, he did.
Where he's just like, he just stands up and gets killed instead of someone else. And he's like, this is all I could think to do. I don't know. It was weird.
This is my plan.
Yeah, that felt like I half expected him or someone around him to be like, let's lock and load or rock and roll or what was the fucking, what's the like the 9/11 plane thing? You know what I'm talking about?
What?
There's this like, there's, you know, the folks who sort of like, on 9/11, there's those folks that like sort of like took the plane back from the hijacker. They still all died, but there's that thing about one of them being like, "Let's lock and load or rock and roll or something."
Let's roll.
Let's roll. Is that what it was? Okay.
Yeah, you're talking about 93, right?
Flight 93. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was halfway expecting something like that. I don't know. This is what only like 8 years after. It still feels like it's there in memory. I don't know. I thought that's what they were getting at with the dude with the army ring, with the airborne ring on. But now he just kind of stands up and doesn't put up a fight. Gets shot in the chest. He doesn't even try to like disarm the guy. It's such a weird scene.
Sorry, I was still thinking about Flight 93, the flight that fought back. No pun intended, but you kind of derailed me there a little bit. Yeah,
sorry.
Yeah. The killing of the hijackers one by one, and then having Denzel like subway his way to like the short, like the emergency exit topside, and he's chasing down John Travolta, and they're on the bridge, and John Travolta's like, you need to shoot me, don't let the fucking cops shoot me, like we all owe God a debt. And Denzel's like, we owe God life. And he's like, I gave you your life back. Now you take mine. Like, give back.
Yeah. I knew finding out that John Travolta was just like a wronged Wall Street guy makes all of his self-important bullshit very funny. like in retrospect too, right?
Like, sure, it's not like he's a holier than thou like preacher man from the beginning. It's not like he's some like pent up like Catholic who's like a criminal who he's a fucking Wall Street dude. He literally has a whole thing about how he took this ass model to Iceland
for
Fashion Week. Yeah, like,
but he's also, but then he's like, you know, you blue collar Denzel Washington and me, we're the same.
we're the same.
Fucked over by the system. I embezzled $10 million and you took a bribe to put your kids in college.
We're the same. And when he's like talking to the mayor and he's like, I wouldn't take that deal, this motherfucker, I bet New York would thank me if I shot you. Well, I am in the minority because not so much, but
ratings.
No. The budget for Taking of Pelham 123 2009 was, we'll call it $105 million.
Looks like it.
The box office take was 150.
Okay.
So barely eking above the line.
Well,
but
like 50% of their over their budget. That's not terrible.
Not great though. I still like, I enjoyed seeing it mainly because I enjoyed the updated I shouldn't say updated because the movie's like 20 some odd years old. Well,
updated as compared to the 30 year old other version of it, right? 30 years
well, like the sure. 50 yeah
it's
yeah.
still it feels very dated, but it's like dated to a slightly more recent time.
Right, yes. It starts out with 99 problems.
Oh god, I forgot about that. Yeah. That when that happened.
Like, oh, I'm like, Tony, this is God, wild. Tony, yeah, God. I'm like, this is wild. Also, there is one thing that maybe kind of irritated me, and they do it two or three times in this movie. There are specific scenes, and one of them is at the 31-minute mark when the mayor is talking to his aide about the money, and the camera is doing this unnecessary spinning around the two characters as they're talking. Right. And Tony watching Scott that like
auteurship,
they do that, they do that two or three times, but it makes me actually dizzy watching that because it's so noticeable and so egregious and so fast because they're trying to make the scene seem like more urgent. But in reality it's just two dudes talking about a ransom on the street as the car with money pulls up to the side of the street, and I'm like, why not just have that be a shot? We don't need the spinning rotating camera. Like the close up and the angle, like the Dutch angle close up spin. I'm like, that's doing too much. That's way too much.
Tony Scott, man, going hard on the weird camera gimmicks.
He does it like two or three times in this movie. And every time I'm like, I feel a little motion sickness from that beat. Like, kind of egregious.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it though, man. Like, overall, I was like, okay.
I didn't hate it. Okay. It's like Denzel really, like, for me, like, carries like the whole movie. Like, John Travolta
he does
really nothing for me. I appreciate that you enjoyed watching him, but God, Denzel is so good.
Well,
and they managed to make
I
him
only like John
better.
Travolta because of Denzel though.
Sure.
Like if there was another actor who didn't have the ability of Denzel Washington, this would not be a good movie. Let me make that incredibly clear. Denzel Washington fucking holds up this movie on his shoulders like Atlas holds the world up. You know what I'm saying? For Denzel, this movie would not do anything.
Also, it's like small detail, but they did such a good job at making Denzel look like a frumpy bureaucrat, you know?
Like they did. He is not some like bad ass, like he's not some secret good with guns killer. He is straight up just like a fucking pin pusher.
When he gets told by John Turturro basically to go home, and he's like, you see him walking away in his like his sad yellow shirt and his khakis and shit, like, and his like his shoulders are all rounded over and stuff. And I'm like, god damn, he looks like a sad sack. That's crazy because like Denzel Washington,
he looks like he's been beaten down.
Yeah,
he looks like he's been beaten down by the system. He's also wearing the same clothes that Walter Matthau wore, or the same color scheme.
Yeah, I like the yellow shirt and the tie there. He just doesn't have the tweed jacket on, which would be weird for 2009.
Yeah. But
what did you think about the two scenes with Denzel Washington's wife? Or maybe it's just the one phone call. Is it just the one phone call? Him?
There's like a few scenes with her, but the phone call is crazy. The phone call is fucking wild.
I get that the thing about the milk is supposed to be like, okay, you're bringing milk home because you're definitely coming home. I get that it's supposed to be the main point of it. But it's so weird in the context of what's going on around them.
Like, I also can't help but feel, like, as I'm watching this, because, okay, for folks who haven't seen this, there's a moment where they start investigating Denzel Washington's character, Garber, because, you know, well, why did you take this desk? How come the hijacker only wants to talk to you?
Yeah, they think some, for a moment, John Turturro, this FBI asshole, is kind of like, they're suspicious of everyone.
This greaseball. He's a greaseball.
Okay. They're saying that as a slur in the movie, so maybe don't.
I don't. Well, I'm not, but, yeah. You know.
Apologies to any Italian listeners for Griffin's transgressions.
So, John Travolta's transgressions, please. It's also weird because he's supposed to be a Jersey guy. And like,
John Travolta like literally born in Jersey.
Right. But in the movie, he like mentions that too. When like Denzel takes a shot and he's like, whoa, I'm like, oh, that is funny because you are born. Like,
it's a strange distinction to be like, oh, John Travolta is actually Irish Catholic in this, not Italian Catholic. Weird.
Now, that scene with Denzel's wife and the cops, when she's like, these police are here and they're saying they have a warrant to come in and check. There's a part of me that I'm like, what was the NYPD like at this in 2009? Like, what was their reputation like?
I think this is like, the height of Stop and Frisk, right? Or at least it's coming. I don't.
It definitely felt, there was another angle when I'm watching this where I'm like, Denzel seemed like, I don't know how comfortable I am with this dynamic now.
I think this movie is like pretty, it feels pretty like pro NYPD. Like in the parts where they.
It does. Well, I mean, you're either pro NYPD or you're pro like crazed hijacker who will shoot people,
well, you
right?
Could have just been neutral. I mean, it's a movie taking place in New York like 8 years after 9/11. There's the cops are gonna be, you know, lionized in it.
If you don't like this movie, Alex, the terrorists win.
Yeah, wait, are the terrorists John Travolta in this one? Because he dies at the end.
Just all terrorists, just all terrorism.
IRA, all of them.
Blanket terrorism.
Yeah.
Maybe this says something more to Denzel Washington's acting ability. Because I was trying to think about this, and I'm like, man, why did I enjoy this movie more than 74? And the characters are characters. But really, Denzel is the only fully fleshed out, well, and John Travolta, but John Travolta, when I first saw John Travolta, I was like, yeah, fucking right.
He's fully like, fleshed he's out, there, he's got the bad beanie. Character.
Right, like, when you first see him on the tracks, he's got the neck tat and the earring, I'm like, get the fuck out of here, like, that is not so, John Travolta.
So fucking corny.
And I'm like, I can't take him, he's not... I haven't heard him speak. I don't know. And then when he gets into the radio shit and he starts like doing the John Travolta like yelling thing, kind of like how Nicolas Cage does, I'm like, oh God, okay.
John Travolta and doing like, Nicolas Cage doing John Travolta in Face Off.
Right. He has a few moments where, oh my God, what if Face Off is where he learned it? And now, like, he just can't stop.
Turned it from Nicolas Cage. And Nicolas Cage yeah. is like, I'm turning down this role, but I also don't need to do it because you have John Travolta, who went to my acting school.
Right. But, yeah, like, I said it earlier, and I'll say it again. Like, Denzel Washington has atlased this film onto his shoulders. His performance of the highs and lows, the embezzlement or the taking the bribe, the interacting with John Travolta over the radio, the acceptance of like him and his wife and his dynamic, You see him go through so many like micro expressions and micro acting moments. I mean, it's just a credit to Denzel, really.
Yeah. I mean, I liked...
If it was a lesser actor of lesser skill, I don't think... I know I would not have liked this movie as much as I did.
I think part of why I like the 70s one a lot is because, like, it feels more balanced than that. Like, in the 2009 one, it was very much like anytime that it wasn't a scene with Denzel Washington, I was kind of like, all right, let's move it along. This is not super compelling. Like, in the 70s, I don't know. I feel like the 70s one just overall was balanced a lot better. Like, everyone had more to do. I wasn't like super bummed out whenever it wasn't a Walter Matthau scene.
The ending of 2009 is better for me, but Robert Shaw as writer is a better writer, and I prefer writer's suicide on the third line because I thought it was way more like, no pun intended, it was way more of a shocking ending. It was way more of like a whoa, like
didn't see that coming.
Did not see that coming at all. And it's... When's the last time a movie surprised you? Like, it's been a while for me where I've seen a movie where I'm like, I didn't see that coming. Or, like, it wasn't telegraphed early on and they kept, like, hinting at it. You know, when's the last time a film did that for you?
Giovanni Ribisi shooting that gun smuggler guy out of nowhere last weekend kind of got me.
But it doesn't seem out of pocket for what the rest of the movie was doing.
Well, I was surprised because of how out of nowhere it was. Like, it was not earned. I was surprised. I don't know. I do really like the ending of the 74 Walter Matthau popping in. It was very funny. But they're doing totally different things tone-wise with it.
Yeah.
I do think that the John Travolta writer is way worse. He would have, like, John Travolta, you could have kept him in there and just had him play, like, not this weirdo version. Like, his character in Broken Arrow isn't, like, shouting all the time. He's calm and cool and collected. The dude's buying and selling nukes. He's, you know, he's doing terrorism, but he's not just, like, screaming all the time.
Isn't he also a bad guy in Swordfish?
Yeah. I haven't seen all of Swordfish in a while. The Hugh Jackman one with Halle Berry, right?
Yeah.
Trying not to mention the one scene everyone knows.
John Travolta's in that, right? I'm remembering that correctly.
Like, and I think there's like one or two times where he freaks out, but like he's mostly like cool and collected the whole time there too. Like, I bought
it. Swordfish was before Face Off. No, it was after Face Off.
Yeah, it was a good deal after, I think. Face Off is like 1997.
Maybe he channels his inner Cage whenever he needs, you know what? Okay, here it is. Here's my theory. Here's the Travolta Cage, like, Exion, right? Here it is. In the aftermath of the passing of Jet, John Travolta has experienced moments of grief, and he hasn't quite settled with it. So his acting has taken a hit, and now he has to draw on the eternal wellspring that is Nicolas Cage, right? And Nicolas Cage shares his acting well with like three or four other actors. And they, like, whenever one of them really needs it, they will pull Cage from that depth and they will channel him a little bit. And I think that's what John Travolta does every now and then. So whenever he's having like a hard time in his life or whenever he's going through something emotional, we will get like a very strange Travolta performance. And I think this is one of those moments.
I think my more serious sort of like thought about what's going on here is I think this is John Travolta just trying to be like, see, I can still do serious acting.
But it doesn't come off as serious a lot of the time.
No, that's, I'm saying it's a big misfire. I don't think it works. I think that was maybe the impetus behind this character. Trying to look. Yeah, he did Wild Hogs in 2007, then Hairspray. Then the animated dog movie Bolt, where he was the voice of Bolt. And then The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3. Oh my god, and then Old Dogs. He was in two different Old Man Pike.
Old men finding out they're young men inside kind of movie.
Oh, I see where it ends. So there's a... In 2004, he's in Ladder 49, and I think that's the last thing I kind of remember being like, okay, he's pretty good in that. Basic. Anyway, I need to.
You're going down the Travolta hole.
I have such a weird place in my heart for this guy, like, but I think it might be totally unearned. I don't know. I really like John Travolta.
Just go back and watch Michael again.
It's not one of my favorite movies of his, but you know, I might. I'm more of a phenomenon guy than a Michael guy.
I was gonna say that.
Like when he spins the sunglasses around.
Just go see Phenomenon again. So this taking of Pelham, honestly, I'd give it like a 6, 6.5.
No, it's exactly the same as the old.
It's the exact same because I enjoyed it more, but only for Denzel.
Yeah.
And Denzel fully carries this movie to a 6 on his own merit, because it's the same story. There is not more, the kidnappers are not more compelling. They're actually a little more cartoony. Right.
They're like, so they took all of those hijacker eggs and put them into the John Travolta basket that is spreading it out.
It is a waste of talent, I think. You have all these really on-screen talent.
James Gandolfini.
Guzman, yeah, like
powerhouse. He just has nothing to do.
Right. It's like the oxygen in the room is being taken up by Travolta and
scenes of him riding a subway. It does feel kind of like criminal how underused James Gandolfini is. That exchange he has with Denzel at the end, like after everything's resolved, and then Denzel's like, "You a Yankees fan?" And then he's like, "No, I mean, yeah, of course I am." And he like kind of looks around jokingly, like that. There was like a little glimmer there of like, "God, they could have been good stuff happening."
it is a total miscast. There could have been so many. Like, I honestly, when I saw John Turturro, I'm like, "Oh, he's got to be a hijacker."
That's what I was thinking too. I thought it was gonna be one of
like John Turturro makes an awesome villain. He makes he plays so such menacing. A good villain, like. He's going to be I was like, okay.
I was a real bummer.
John Travolta.
Because
going
from the Batman to this, like, or like John Turturro wise, being like, God, he was so good at the Batman. And then, he just has nothing to do here.
I was like, okay. In my mind, I'm like, all right, I know John Travolta is lead kidnapper guy. I know Denzel is going to be guy on the phone, but the other characters, I'm like, oh, there's going to be some great interplay with these guys. Like, they're going to get to shine. This movie's going to be awesome. Like, this movie. And then I'm like, okay, so, like, it's the Denzel Washington John Travolta show. They're they're chewing all the scenes. They're sucking up all the air. And we're left with all this other talent that's being criminally misused. But again, you know, because it's Denzel, it at least for me gets an automatic 6.
Sure. I mean, yeah, he's quite good. This is the only, very good in this. And I like this more. I like this remake more than, I guess, like the Manchurian Candidate, the other Denzel Washington remake we watched for this. That is, I think that one has a lot of the same problems where like Denzel is quite good in it, but like everyone else is kind of just like, not so hot, and they replace some.
I kind of wish American Gangster. Kind of wish American Gangster got a remake or whatever. Watch that movie again. Yeah.
That's a good movie. I like that scene.
It is a good movie. It's a great movie. Yeah, but it's just like, yeah. I mean, okay, if you're gonna go watch Taking of Pelham 123. I would say either is a good choice. Alex would say 74 is the better choice.
I would say it depends on the mood you're in. If you want to watch a gritty Tony Scott crime movie, then the 2009 one. But if you like, I think if you just want to like sit down and have a fun time, then the 70s one is a better option.
Okay, should we get the elephant out of the semi-elephant out of the room here?
What's the elephant? I don't.
We keep like Tony Scott, right? Tony Scott's like done a bunch of movies. He's passed away for like long now, like what, 10, 15 years?
2012. Died.
Who is his brother?
Oh, Ridley Scott. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. There we go. Yes. He is the brother of Ridley Scott.
Is that the elephant? I mean, I mean, Ridley Scott also good. There are many better like Ridley Sir Scott movies Ridley than, Scott than this.
I mean,
most Ridley Scott movies are a better choice than the 2009 one.
Right,
I would say.
Like iconic fucking Ridley Scott, like Blade Runner, Alien.
Tony Scott's the youngest of three brothers. I don't think the middle one is a director, but it would be tough to be like Tony Scott, lots of successful movies, but then your brother is Ridley Scott. Like, that sucks.
Right. That's a bummer. Well, I mean, it's Paul McCartney has a brother. And Paul McCartney's brother had a band, and they had a hit in the 70s. But compare that to fucking Paul McCartney.
Well, you know, at least they don't go the real, like, shitbag brother route. Like, what was the fucking... Who's that guy?
Band, like,
Billy Beer? Remember the fucking...
What?
I got it. Sorry. What were you about to say?
So, the song is called Lily the Pink, and it's by a band called The Scaffold. And that's Mike McGear, who is the brother of Paul McCartney. So it's like, okay, they have this kind of hit, but you're sitting across the table from a fucking Beatle. You know, like Tony Scott has a bunch of movies, did a bunch of movies in his own right, and a lot of them, a decent amount of them, are really like well known. They're big seller, like they're big box office hits, but you look across the table and there's fucking Ridley Scott.
I feel like more people would know the director of Alien than would know the director of Top Gun.
Should that, yeah. Of course. Like, and I have Top seen Gun
because it's probably Tony Scott, like, biggest movie.
His biggest movie. Right. And like, I've seen so many movies from Scott Free Productions, you know?
Like the dude that, like that. Is that Ridley Scott's production company?
Yeah.
Okay. I think that's also Michael Scott's from The Office fake company. Oh, no, this is Great Scott. Sorry, my bad.
Great, yeah.
Great Scott.
But, yeah, like, Ridley Scott's just done everything. He's worked with everyone. So, for Taking of Pelham 123, like another Tony Scott film, he's never going to be able to do what his brother can do behind the camera. But, you know, I like Domino. I like Beverly Hills Cop 2. I like Top Gun. I even like Taking of Pelham 123. But all of his movies... Yeah, like even his really good ones, they're a little bit campy, they're a little bit corny, the characters don't always exactly mesh.
Yeah,
like, his movies always leave me wanting more.
Like I keep on saying, like, I like Domino, and I do, but I don't really think it's like a great movie. I don't know who I'd recommend it to. Like, I like it because of some weird, like, it's a weird movie about bounty hunters and fucking Tom Waits is in it. Like, that's why I like it, you know?
It's also based off, like, a true story.
Kind of. I think it's based off of a pretty heavily embellished, like, autobiography of some bounty hunter guy.
Well, it's... It's Domino Harvey, right? Like, it's her movie. Like, that's why it's called Domino, because Domino Harvey is an actual bounty hunter.
God damn it. Isn't the dude from The Wrestler, like, her, like, sort of mentor in it?
Yeah, fucking Mickey Rourke.
Mickey Rourke. Yeah.
It's Keira Knightley and Mickey Rourke. Anyway,
I mean, that movie is a mess. It's like, I liked it, but I don't know if I would have to know a lot about it first before I recommended it to him.
I mean, I like Domino because it's just it's a fun movie. I can stick it on and just enjoy some like cool action. I get to see Keira Knightley and Mickey Rourke. Also, like, Christopher Walken and Lucy Liu are in it, and that's cool.
Oh, yeah. They got a lot of good people to show up in that movie. It's interesting.
Yeah, it's, you know, cool movie. But Tony Scott's movies always, like, you wish he would do a little more with his actors. Like, give his, like, especially in Taking of Pelham, give your supporting cast are really not a supporting cast. These are like Hollywood heavyweights. Like, they're like very well respected acting forever. They can fucking destroy a scene if they're given the opportunity. So let them breathe, you know?
Yeah, they're mostly reduced to like set dressing in a lot of these scenes.
Right.
We think we're going to see Totoro get to do a little bit, but then it's like John Travolta's character just hates him. He kills a guy because he doesn't like the sound of his voice so much, and then they get Denzel back. Like
how cool would it have been if we, like, everyone in the in the controller station is an unknown except for Denzel, and we have Luis Guzman being the second controller. Yeah. And then we got John Turturro being the secondary to, like, the other voice of reason in there with Travolta. Like, that would have been a much better movie.
Yeah, like, I liked, in the 74 one, you have, like, other people chiming in or whatever. In this one, there's that one guy who just keeps on being like, you're doing a great job, Denzel. It's, like, his only line. He just repeats it about 10 times at various points, right? Such good actors in this. It would have been cool to see more of an ensemble cast. I think it's, like, really telling that two of the hijackers basically don't have any IMDb credits. Like, they don't have pictures by their names.
Right.
Like, those are supposed to be major roles. They have, I think, zero lines. Like, they're on the train. Maybe one of them says something about getting hit in the face. And then they do nothing until they get shot in the middle of Times Square later or whatever.
Now, I'm not going to just, you know, Tony Scott aside, there is another person who we can kind of hold a little responsible to this. I'd say equally responsible. And that is the screenwriter, Brian Helgeland.
Okay.
He is responsible for A Nightmare on Elm Street 4. He is responsible for Assassins.
Nightmare on Elm Street 4, too, is like the one where the franchise gets way goofier and worse in my humble opinion.
He is a writer for LA Confidential.
Okay, that's good, right?
The movie The Postman.
Okay.
The Mel Gibson movie Payback, A Knight's Tale, Mystic River, Man on Fire, Robin Hood, Spencer Confidential, Legend. He was also a writer for Friday the 13th, the series, and Tales from the Crypt.
Okay, that's pretty varied career. I mean, there's some really good stuff in there, though. So, I don't know. They can't all be hits, I guess. Or
The Clint Eastwood thriller that no one fucking remembers, Bloodwork.
Okay. I mean, I liked A Knight's Tale, and there was a few others in there that I think I enjoyed.
Yeah, but Knight's Tale, let's attribute Knight's Tale to Chaucer, right? Because he's the one who wrote that in the first place, like, what, 1500 years ago or some shit?
Okay, but we literally wouldn't understand
you need to go back and read Canterbury Tales, sir.
If it was,
that's what this sounds like to me. You need to go. I'm going to send you to Chaucer's corner.
I don't think Chaucer had the foresight to be like, you know what we need right here? A sweet ass queen number. That's all the other guy, whose name I've already forgotten.
I rest my case, good sir.
I don't know the name of most screenwriters. This is not a gotcha.
Oh, shit. Alex, when it comes to Taking of Pelham 1, 2, 3, do you think it deserves a reboot, or should we deboot it?
I think there's probably a version of this, you know? honestly, like, I had a good time with the 70s one. I think that's fine.
I'm going to deboot, too, because, honestly, it's a niche concept.
It does still, we're going to have four dudes trapped in a tube for an hour and a half. Okay, great.
We're doing a train heist. Oh, we're going to do a disconnected subway car in the middle of New York.
A train heist, what? But get this, the train doesn't move for the majority of the film.
The train does not move. It's a hostage situation. Oh, like in a bank, like Point Break? No, not at all. We're like, oh.
Executive decision. No, also no.
Yeah, it's such a niche thing. And, like, you're not going to get any more, like, 1970s cool than a movie from the 70s, like Taking of Pelham. And you're not going to get a better performance than fucking Denzel.
I would say if you really like factoids about the subway, then this movie is for you, though. Definitely the subway.
Or the book.
Yeah, the book specific. But the, I feel like the movie, despite a couple of like N-words getting dropped, the movie significantly tones down the racism of the book.
Oh, right, the racism of the book. I forgot the book was littered with racism.
Keeps a good amount of the subway factoids. I feel like it's a good balance there.
Okay. All right. Well, do you have any final thoughts for the audience? And final, words?
Zoom tight.
All right. And, guys, we are taking a break next week. So Alex and I can sit down with the committee and we can really talk about the rebooties. Yeah. We're going to have some special stuff. Yeah, we got to get tuxes. We got to get camera crew. We got to get catering. We're going to have some special guest appearances, maybe some interviews with some people. I may or may not know if Mr. James Stewart will show up again. Who can tell? Okay. You know, sure. It's gonna be a big day. Next week we're taking a week off. Then we'll be back with the first ever Rebooty Award Show, celebrating 100 episodes of Reboot Deboot.
Yeah, that's the centennial. All right.
So we will see you guys not next week, but the week after.
That podcast is filling your head with garbage. You should be in school.
Well, we better get going. I wonder, will we ever see each other again?
Who knows? God willing, we'll all meet again in Spaceballs 2 to search for more money.